I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about a serious and looming problem, the coming shortage of doctors in Indiana and America. We'll talk about what's causing the problem, what its effects are likely to be in a state and country with a graying population, and what can be done about it. We'll talk about all of this with three guests: Dr. Paul Evans of Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine, Dr. Debbie Allen, director of the IU School of Medicine's Bowen Research Center, and Dr. Pat Bangston, associate dean of IU School of Medicine Northwest. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the looming shortage of doctors in Indiana and America on No Limits today. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I've got a great group of guests today. In the studio with me are Dr. Debbie Allen, who is with the IU School of Medicine's Bowen Research Center. She's the director. Dr. Allen, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. Also with me in the studio is Dr. Paul Evans, who is the founding dean of the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine. Dr. Evans, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Pat Bangston of the IU School of Medicine Northwest. He is the associate dean. Dr. Bangston, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you here. Well, let's start out. Give me some perspective on how large this problem is right now. We're talking about several forces. We'll talk about what's producing it, but in terms of the coming shortage, what are we really looking at? Can you put it in some sort of perspective for us, Dr. Allen?
You can measure it a variety of ways, so the answer will depend on who's measuring it. It's not a looming shortage. There's a current shortage.
Mm-hmm. And how bad a current shortage?
If you're looking just at primary care doctors, the average in this, the guess in the state would be between 800 and 2,000. And I don't know if Dr. Evans has a different take on that or not, but I've been tracking physician supply and demand in the state for about 25 years, and that's an educated guess.
Okay. When did it start? I mean, has it always been a problem, or at what point did it begin to accelerate?
We've been tracking it since 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been a shortage, but it's also a shortage and a maldistribution. We know that, for example, the physician per population ratio is much lower in rural mm-hmm. Indiana, and we actually have a variety of underserved areas that are actually designated that by the government, and we have underserved inner city areas where we have populations that are uninsured or underinsured, and they have problems getting access to the appropriate primary care.
Okay. Dr. Evans, is that a realistic assessment of where we are?
Yes,
your numbers
it is.
Differ at all, or
the problem is actually a national problem as well as an Indiana problem.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the nation, many of the estimates, if you actually look at projections of physician workload data and the needs of the citizens of the United States. The projection is by 2020 to 25, we will have almost 160,000 doctor shortage in the United States. So that's an ominous figure. Indiana certainly has a part of that. The study that Dr. Allen was quoting was actually an IU study that was done by Doug McCaig and his colleagues in about 5-8 years ago, where in fact His projections for the year 2020 showed that Indiana will be short about 5,000 doctors, 2,000 of which will be primary care doctors. If you look at national statistics of where Indiana is in relation to the rest of the country, Indiana ranks 38th out of 50 in doctors per 100,000. It's a little better over the past 2 years. I've been here since 2010. We've improved from 40th to 38th. That's a step in the right direction, but it's still not really where Indiana needs
to be. Is that sort of a math, you know, a math game though, in that we're just losing ground less rapidly than other parts of the country, or is it that we've actually made gains?
Well, it's probably a little bit of both, but the difference between 40th and 38th is really not that much.
Yeah, and Dr. Bangston, in terms of why don't we shift this ever so slightly? How does this impact the average Hoosier? I mean, what's the impact for people? Why should they be worried about this?
Well, we're kind of in a perfect storm situation. Not only do we have a physician shortage that's been talked about since 2006 when the Association of American Medical Colleges recognized the problem and asked medical schools to increase their enrollment by 30%, but also, and that's caused predominantly by retirement, a third of the physicians are of an age that they would retire in the next 10 years, and the aging baby boomer population that's going to require more medical care, and other factors. And added to that is the Affordable Care Act, which will bring much more demand on healthcare providers for services. And so you add all of that together, and it would mean that people are increasingly going to have difficulty seeing a doctor.
Let's stay with that for a second. When you talk about the affordable, what will the impact of affordable care, the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, be on this problem?
Well, I can speak to that a little bit. Perhaps Dr. Allen would be a better source for that. But the bottom line is that with more people being insured or having higher quality insurance, that there will be more of a demand on the system for services. Many of the things that will be covered that weren't covered before in insurance. And so the thought is, especially in primary care, that there will be a tremendous increase in demand for services. I've been told that, especially in primary care, that the services provided that are typically were not covered by insurances now will be, and that amount of work alone could occupy the services of every single primary care doctor in America. So the problem is significant.
Dr. Allen has been nodding her head while you were talking. I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Dr. Allen, could you talk a little bit, you know, we've talked about that the demand will increase. Do we have any estimates on how much the demand will increase or anything that gives us some sort of barometer as to what we're looking at? Barometer works, obviously, with a perfect storm metaphor that we're using here.
What is the estimate for the state? 4 million? I don't know. No, that's high.
For the uninsured?
Yeah. No, it's Milliman actually published a report saying for Indiana that the estimated load for new ACA-related covered lives is between 500,000 and 750,000. Now, that's a significant number of people. It's also interesting that those additional people are not part of the statistics that we're quoting for you. Those new numbers were not part of the calculus that was made together to say these are the things.
So our analysis of the situation is already out of date.
It's probably worse.
It's worse than we anticipate.
It changes on a daily basis because the factors that go into the equation change. For example, this year you were talking about what changes have occurred. This year, insurance companies were forced to cover for no cost to the patient a yearly screening physical. And, of course, what happens is that for the first 6-8 weeks of this year, I saw 90% physicals because everybody was going to get in and get what their insurance company was going to pay for. And it actually has been very good. Lots of people who didn't come in previously have come in now. But it also it creates a new, all my chronic care gets pushed to the back if everybody's calling in for their physical firsts.
How much of this, I mean, we've made reference that obviously Affordable Care Act is part of the calculation, but each of you has also talked about the fact that, you know, we've got a graying population, people are living longer, the fact that that we have done, I guess what I'm saying is this a product of success at some level? The fact that we have been able to enhance people's lives, give them longer lifespans in which they're healthy and active also then creates far more demand on the system as well. Dr. Bankston.
Yeah, it's a unique situation. I mean, it is the product of success. It's kind of interesting that we always talk about prevention in terms of it's the right thing to do to prevent illness. But in fact, what an unintended consequence is to have people live longer and they experience the diseases of the oldest old. And since they are on government funds and Medicare, that increases the cost of Medicare to all of us. And so it is a product of our success, and so prevention can, in fact, decrease cost in the short term, but in the end, it may kick the ball down the road to increase cost later on. So prevention is a good thing. I'm not saying it's not, but it's not going to solve the money problem.
What other piece of this? I mean, you mentioned that a third of the doctors, who are working now are going to be retiring in the next few years. Dr. Evans.
Actually, if you look at the projections, I'm a family physician and Dr. Allen is a family physician. I can tell you it's kind of scary because in 2017, the Graham Center predicts that the number of retiring physicians in the United States will actually exceed the number of graduating physicians from residency programs in family medicine. So that is particularly ominous when you look at the people who take care of these elderly people. Projections nationally say that from 2000 to 2030, the over 65 population in the U.S. actually will double. They require about twice the amount of doctor visits and medical care as their younger compatriots. And so because of that, you have an increasing need and you have a decreasing number of, at least in the family medicine community, a decreasing number of family physicians that are going to be able to take care of those folks.
If part of the problem, it sounds like, is that we aren't getting enough people going into medicine, why is that?
Well, that's not exactly true. We have plenty of people who want to go into medicine. IU School of Medicine had 4,700 applications for 344 slots last year. So there are lots of people. I mean, it's still a very popular profession from the point of view of people wanting to get in. The problem is the supply from medical schools, even though, as has been referred to, as Dr. Allen said, in 2006 when this all hit the fan in terms of the Association of Medical Colleges study, most medical schools in the country tried to increase their numbers by 30%, as IU did. And then on top of that, as we've referred to, the ACA came in, which even exacerbates the problem of a shortage of physicians. Of course, we have new medical schools and osteopathic schools, as our guests can attest, and that's helpful. But still, the physician supply is not going to, from U.S. medical schools, really can't keep up, and we won't. And so then alternatives have to be derived, and we've relied on foreign medical physicians and others. And then the new emphasis on alternative providers at the appropriate level of their education, you know, nurse practitioners and physician's assistants who can take up some of the slack. And I think that that's probably the wave of the future and the way that this is going to be at least attempted to be solved.
We are talking about the shortage of doctors here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Dr. Evans, actually, Dr. Bankston kind of set this up. We probably ought to tell people what osteopathic medicine is, what the definition is there.
Yes. Osteopathic medicine is a profession that, with our MD colleagues, are the only two type of fully trained physicians in the United States. We're licensed by the same licensing board. We take very similar examinations and assessments. We do the same residencies, and our practice areas are essentially identical to our MD colleagues.
What's the difference, though? A little bit different
because we are a little more holistically oriented. We are very mindful of the concept that structure and function are intimately related. We have an emphasis in our curriculum on wellness and prevention. We also teach our students a kind of a mind-body-spirit approach. Osteopathic medicine actually also emphasizes the musculoskeletal system, and we teach osteopathic manipulative therapy as part of our curriculum. So we are a little bit different.
We are talking about the shortage of doctors here on No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the shortage of doctors in Indiana and America, and my guests are Dr. Pat Bankston, he's the associate dean of the IU School of Medicine Northwest, Dr. Debbie Allen, who is with the Bowen Research Center at the IU School of Medicine in Indianapolis, and Dr. Paul Evans, who is the founding dean of the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine. That's a lot of titles there to get through. We were talking before the break about the fact that many of the medical schools had been asked to ramp up their enrollments. How do you go about doing that? I mean, you know, Dr. Bankston had made the point that it's not that there'd been a shortage of people who wanted to get into medical school. So presumably, though, I would think the challenge would be ramping up the enrollment but still making sure that there's some guarantee of quality on the back end. Dr. Evans, you're nodding your head emphatically, so I'll let you speak to that first.
In fact, there has been some significant efforts to address the shortage of physicians from the medical school level. If you look at projections of where MD enrollment is happening from 2002 until projected 2014, the MD enrollment at those medical schools nationally is expected to increase 21%. Now, in the osteopathic world, we've actually done a little bit better job of that, and our enrollment is expected to increase over 103% for a national increase, as our other guests talked about, of 34%. So we have been increasing the total numbers of students. However, we have not been keeping up with the population. And if you look at first-year MD enrollment figures per 100,000 people in the population from 1990 until projected 2020, the number of medical students per population will decrease from 7.3 down to about 5.0. So although we are increasing, we're still really not keeping up with our population.
And is it difficult, Dr. Allen? Is it the challenge one of maintaining the quality? You know, obviously, most people, when they think about their doctors, want to make sure that person is incredibly well-trained.
I think that looking at the statistics on the type and quality of the student applying to medical school would tell you that the quality has not changed, and it still remains a profession that some of our best and brightest want to go into.
Is it, but in terms of even with the 34% growth, did I hear you correctly, Dr. Evans? 34% growth, we're still not keeping pace with the demand? I mean, how much more open can you turn the spigot here to let people in with while still maintaining that quality of commitment, Dr. Evans? Commitment to quality, not quality of commitment. Sorry.
Yes. One of the challenges that we have is it's very expensive to provide medical education for both MD and DO learners in this country. The challenges of new technology, the expense of very, very sophisticated and well-trained faculty members, the management of teaching hospitals, all of those things are part of the process of doing that. I can tell you that there is, as we talked about earlier, there certainly are plenty of well-qualified applicants that are trying to get into medical school. We heard about the IU statistics of over 7,000 applicants. At Marion, we had 3,352 applicants for our 150 accredited seats. So, and the quality is pretty much the same, a little bit lower, but pretty much the same as what we see in our IU colleagues. So it's not that we have unqualified applicants. We have very qualified applicants. I think one of the challenges of producing the doctors that we need for Indiana and for the country has to do not just in medical school enrollment, but also in residency programs. Mm-hmm. And if you actually look at Indiana as an example, the total number of graduates of medical schools, the IU program roughly about 330 to 340 projected over the next 3 to 5 years. Marion's first class will graduate in 2017. That figures out to be roughly about 500 plus or minus graduates from accredited schools in Indiana. But yet when you look at residency programs and look at the total number of postgraduate year one opportunities for these graduates in the state of Indiana, they do not match up to the total number of graduates that we have. Last year, the total number of PGY1 spots in Indiana was 471, and the match to what students are looking for as graduates versus what the communities need in terms of primary care and other specialties, there's actually a mismatch there. So,
how big a mismatch?
Well, it depends on what school you look at and what specialty you talk about. The graduates in 2012 are interested very much in specialty and subspecialty training, which does not include primary care. So the primary care selection numbers by graduates in the United States, in fact, is going down. That's very concerning to people who are in rural and underserved areas where the physicians that provide the bulk of medical care are, in fact, primary care doctors.
I'm going to shift the conversation slightly in a second, but and before we leave this, we say we've ramped up enrollments in medical schools by 34% on average, and we're still not keeping pace. What is the target number we have to get to? Dr. Allen or Dr. Bankston, I'll let either one of you take a look at that. I mean, what range do we have to go? Or Dr. Evans, they're punting it toward you. So,
well, I can share with you, based on the IU projections that were done by McCaig et al., the need for Indiana doctors by 2020 is about 5,000. That's a lot of physicians, 2,000 of which are projected to be needed in primary care. And again, these are pre-ACA numbers. So we think that the needs are actually going to even be higher.
Yeah, and IU has increased its enrollment starting in 2006 in the last 7 years by about 60 students, and the total that we were going to increase them by is 84 students each year in order to reach our 30% increase. That's only 84 doctors increase, and look at the numbers that you were just told. You know, mm-hmm. It's impossible to keep up with the demand, and again, those numbers were pre-Affordable Care Act, so there's actually going to be an increase in demand.
We are talking about the shortage of doctors in Indiana and America here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Sharon, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was calling about the utilization of nurse practitioners. I recently had the experience of going to the nurse practitioner at my family doctor's, and I'm a Medicare patient with private subsidy insurance. Mm-hmm. And I was horrified to find out it cost me more, or it cost Medicare more, for me to go to the nurse practitioner, because I not only paid for her, I paid an additional amount for the doctor, who I didn't see, to supervise her. I would like someone to address that issue, because I've never heard it addressed. When I called to sort of say, my goodness, is this accurate? They said, oh, yes, she has to be supervised. Therefore, her supervising physician charges his fee also.
Thank you very much for the call, Sharon. We'll see whether we can get you an answer here. Well, does anybody? Yeah, Dr. Evans.
I've never heard of that.
Neither have I.
Dr. Bankston, shall we make it complete?
Yeah, although I will say that last time I went to my cardiologist, I did see a physician assistant, and I thought it was a fantastic experience. And very frankly, for what I needed, which was a quick checkup of my heart, listen to my chest, listen to my heart, and talk about my medications, it was perfectly adequate healthcare in my view. I think that aside from the point that the caller talked about, I think this is the wave of the future to have more patients seen at the appropriate level of care, and I think the other guests will nod about this one too, that at the appropriate level of their training to see patients in kind of routine matters that do not require the exquisite diagnostic skills and training of physicians, and therefore manage costs, aside from what the caller said.
We've been talking, obviously, about the areas of shortage, and I think Dr. Allen at the top of the program said, that in rural areas often it's difficult to find doctors or place doctors in inner city areas. But we also, there's a different kind of area too when we're talking about the areas of care. Are there particular areas where we have seen the impact? I keep hearing primary care physician mentioned over and over again here. Is that really the front line on this, Dr. Allen?
Yes, because primary care is the front line of medicine, and we need to enter the field and the area of medicine through primary care doctors or primary care providers.
And why is it? Why do we have such a shortage of primary care physicians? What is that? Is it a disproportionate shortage in comparison with the rest of it? Dr. Evans, you're nodding your head.
Yes, primary care. Actually, the percentage of graduates going into primary care, not only in MD institutions but in DO institutions, is going down. And there are a number of factors that are related to that.
Why would that be?
One would be the salary levels of primary care doctors is significantly below specialists. There's a huge increase in educational debt for medical students graduating now. The average private osteopathic student last year had an educational debt in excess of $210,000. Our MD colleagues are very similar to that. So that really weighs on the mind of somebody making a specialty selection. Primary care is a little less amenable to very fixed and predictable scheduling. Mm-hmm. People in primary care see obstetrics, and they see people who are sick at all different times of the day and night and holidays and weekends, and they have to respond to that, which means that lifestyle issues are sometimes compromised, and our new graduates look at that and understand that that's kind of the price they pay when they go into primary care. So all of those aspects are influencing the choice of our medical school graduates to say, what specialty am I going to choose?
Well, in terms of, so we get an idea, I mean, $210,000 worth of debt on average is going to strike people who are listening as just a staggering amount. What kind of income on average would a primary care physician be able to look at?
The average family physician now makes roughly about $160,000 to $170,000 a year. The latest statistics on looking at salaries and other specialties gets up close to around $350,000 to $400,000 for anesthesiology, for urology, for orthopedics, some of the specialty.
So 2 to 3 times as much then. So we've created, in effect, a system in which the economic incentives drive people away from the front line of medical care. Is that
right.
Correct, Dr. Allen?
I think that's right, and it's very hard for us to pin that down because obviously medical students go in thinking they want to provide good quality care and give back to society, and when you ask them about did your debt have anything to do with your choice, they say, no, I wanted to provide care because I had this experience here. But when we go back and track it, the higher the debt, there's definitely a correlation to their lack of interest in primary care.
And is that 210 on average, is that for the primary care, the students who are going to go into primary care?
It's for all medical students.
For all medical students. So, in effect, by opting to specialize in certain areas, you can put yourself on a path where you could eliminate that debt in a year or two if you chose to.
Just to give you an example of what that means, just for fun, I took that debt load of a student that told me that he had a $210,000 debt, and I said, he came to me and said, you know, Dr. Evans, he says, when I graduate, that is a mortgage without a house. And so I actually went to Google and looked at it as if it were a mortgage and put 4% rating, and it figures out to about $1,900 a month for 30 years.
A lot of money. So in terms of primary care, are there other areas where we're seeing shortages?
There's several.
Yes.
Several? What are the other ones?
In rural areas, we're finding we're getting a shortage of general surgeons also. And they're the second most common physician in a rural setting, and we need general surgeons in rural America still. And we're short on, I would say, all primary care. Mm-hmm. In Indiana, we really, really have a shortage of psychiatrists also. We just don't have a solid training method to get a bunch of psychiatrists in the state either. But I think there is a need in all specialties. It's just a matter of which ones are the biggest.
We are talking about the shortage of doctors in Indiana and in the United States. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a physical therapist in Indiana, and you were talking about alternate ways to get people into the medical system. And as of July 1st in the state of Indiana, physical therapists will be able to see patients without referral from a physician. I might mention that Indiana is like the last state in the country to do this, but we finally got that, and we would be able to see someone for up to 24 calendar days, and at that point either discharge them or refer them to a physician.
Thank you very much for the call, Mary.
Mm-hmm. So that would be a different way for people, you know, to get some access.
Thank you. Well, and I'm wondering, you know, in terms of this, are there ways like the earlier caller, Sharon, who made the argument that, you know, she would see a nurse practitioner, but she was actually getting charged more for doing that. Is some of this also ways that we can tweak the insurance system or the Affordable Care Act to create perhaps more effective ways to A, alleviate some of the pressure on the doctor's time, but also to keep the cost down? Anyone want to take that? Dr. Bankston, you've been silent for a bit.
I don't think any of us are experts on this kind of thing. These kinds of problems have been around for 20 or 30 years in terms of the kinds of doctors that there are and the reimbursements for what doctors do. And very frankly, it's always the case that people who do procedures get more money than people who just talk to people and give advice and do diagnostic things. And it's been a problem for an awfully long time, and no one has come up with an adequate solution for it. From time to time, people talk about increasing Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement for primary care doctors. But in the end, it always turns out that procedure-based medicine, we're talking about surgery and some of the medicine subspecialties that do procedures like cardiology or others, GI, end up getting paid more than others. So I think it's a very difficult thing. And the panelists are right. I mean, I am on the admissions committee, and every student who comes here, not every, but almost a lot of students will say they want to go into primary care when they interview for medical school. But then
Dr. Bankston, we'll have to pick that up on the other side. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the shortage of doctors in this state and country. My guests are Dr. Pat Bankston of the IU School of Medicine Northwest, Dr. Debbie Allen, the Bowen Research Center at IU School of Medicine in Indianapolis, and Dr. Paul Evans, who is the founding dean of the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a question from a listener named Don who didn't want to go on the air, who said, is part of the solution might be letting more foreign doctors into the country or system? Is that at least a Band-Aid that we could use for this problem, Dr. Evans?
Well, actually, international medical graduates are a significant part of our process in the United States in providing medical care. Our residency programs roughly are 20 to 25% filled with international graduates. They train here. They practice particularly not only in urban areas, but certainly in some rural and underserved areas. So they're a significant help in providing medical care for citizens of the United States. There's some looks now at the percentage of international graduates in our residency programs, and is this, in fact, what's optimum for our country, given that we're now increasing the number of graduates in our medical schools, and we're really not increasing the total number of residency spots, not only in Indiana, but in around the country. So I think that's an area that's generating a lot of discussion in all areas of medical education.
Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is maybe we're not looking at some other unintended consequences. For instance, if even with all the strain and stress that the medical system is going to undergo with the millions of new people that are going to be coming into it because of the Affordable Care Act, we also have to look at the fact that getting those people in now and giving them routine medical care consistently is going to save money, and we really don't know how much that is. And whatever that is, and I don't doubt any doctor is going to agree that it's going to save money, that money can be channeled into medical education. And I think that's something that has to be looked at and factored in when we're starting to wring our hair about stresses and strains on the system. And I'll hang up and listen to comments.
Great. Thank you very much for the call. Well, in terms of we have looked at the downside of all of this, and what Joe's doing is making an argument here that there could be an upside, that the more preventative care, are there ways to reduce both the pressures on the system and perhaps reduce the numbers of doctors that we would need through preventative care? Is that a realistic possibility, Dr. Evans?
Yeah, certainly it is. Prevention is a cornerstone of good primary care. Actually, the statistics, that if you look at people that have primary care and look at the states with the highest number of primary care physicians per 100,000 and compare them on certain measures, and this data is actually consistent over the past 10 to 20 years, the number of incidents of morbidity and mortality related to looking at having a family doctor is actually about a third less in the states that have a high number of primary care doctors versus states that do not. Mm-hmm. Conversely, and this goes towards the caller's comment, if you look at the quality of medicine and subsequently the cost of medical care, mm-hmm. those states that have high numbers of primary care doctors are about a third less costly than those states that don't have that number of primary care. So I think there's a compelling argument that is historical that says if you have an increased number of primary care doctors, you not only increase the quality, but you also decrease the cost.
So part of it is a possible solution then figuring out some way to more incentivize primary care.
Yes.
Physicians here, that creates, but it means really altering the way we compensate doctors to some degree, right?
There is some of that in the Affordable Care Act. They're saying that we're going to be paid for the quality we provide, and that we're going to get paid for the preventative services, and as we manage these patients and keep them out of the more expensive emergency rooms and hopefully prevent other illnesses, that our income will increase. And I hope so, but I have a feeling that what they've done is just they've added a little more work onto my load, and that my pay will probably remain about the same.
We've gotten it, and this gets to this subject that we're talking about. A listener named Michael called in and did not want to go on the air, but wondered if the debt, the student loans that medical students rack up, serves as a deterrent for them to go in. I mean, if it's obviously it's a demanding profession, and I would think that would be a little bit daunting if you're 22 years old and you're looking at it and thinking, oh, if I decide this is not something I want to do and I'm going to come out of here with more money than I could reasonably expect it to pay back in the next, 30 years, what do I do? Do you find that, Dr. Allen?
In talking to students, most of them are not, straightforward enough to tell you that, but you have to say that if 20 years ago I was faced with that exact same situation, I'd have to say, wow, I don't know that I can afford to do what I want to do. I may be forced to do something close to what I want to do just to pay for my education.
How much preparation in medical schools? Dr. Banks, and I'll throw this one to you too. Is there on the business side of running a medical practice?
Well,
because it is. It's a fairly sophisticated business you have to run in addition to take care of people.
It's a very sophisticated business, and very frankly, in the curriculum of medical school, and I suspect osteopathic schools, we don't really do a very good job of that. It is part of the mandates for residency programs to talk about practice-based medicine and those kinds of things, and maybe that's more appropriate as the students get closer to their wherever they find their work and the situation that they're in. We have had mandates as part of our accreditation requirement to talk about financial management. In terms of how you can manage the debt that you incur, but also and in admissions in our admissions process, we have our financial aid person come and talk to our students about how to finance medical education, what you can expect in terms of your total debt. So we try to let students know some of these things about their debt and what they're going to face when they get into practice, but very frankly, it's really not been part of our curriculum that's emphasized.
We are talking about the shortage of doctors in Indiana and America here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Marianne, welcome to the program.
Well, hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
On my mind is that there is money in the Affordable Care Act for family practice doctors to be paid for services to Medicaid patients, what is paid for Medicare patients. And the state of Indiana has been sitting on that money for 5 months. The Indiana State Medical Association doesn't know where the money is or when it will be paid. We get $32 to see a Medicaid patient. I paid $105 to have my refrigerator looked at. Now, why can't we pay family practice doctors what we should be paying them, for starters? And why can't we pay them a reasonable salary?
Thank you very much for the call, Marianne.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Well, in terms of that, there was some funding that's supposed to come from the federal government to the state. I'm assuming that is what, and there's been some back and forth in terms of the state and particularly Governor Pence in regard to whether we would accept those funds or not. Would that make things easier here if we did? Dr. Evans.
It probably would. Actually, if you look at historically what's happened with the fees for physicians, there's some great Medicare data from the 1980s up until now, and the fees for doctors actually have not gone up. They've actually gone down 25% in terms of reimbursement for doctor care. But yet when you look at the expenses for running an office and looking at a medical practice, the expenses since 2001 to 2012 has actually gone up 56%. So that puts doctors in a bit of a squeeze here as to how to make sure that the books balance. The proposal in ACA, and it hasn't, as I know it, it has not really been specific, but they talked about an increase of 7% in the reimbursement for family physicians. But yet, this past year, Medicare reimbursements, as I understand it, went down 2% across the board. So we're getting mixed messages here as to what's going on. So I don't know the specific answer.
You know, if I could jump in here, the part of the ACA is an increase in support for the federally qualified health centers, which are most communities have that serve predominantly Medicaid patients. And that model, it's sort of a different model of healthcare, and it's a model that's based on a kind of team approach and seeing patients at the appropriate level of care with the appropriate kind of healthcare provider so that nurses and nurse practitioners can take care of problems that are appropriate to their education, and that doctors are used only when patients have problems that require that level of care. And it's kind of a different model. I mean, it's sort of an ideal model in a sense. And then there are other models that are being supported by the ACA that involve groups of physicians that are involved in the patient care collectively, so that they can deal with problems in a non-silo manner and theoretically at least save money and give a better care for the same amount of dollars. So there are sort of innovative things that look like they're on the horizon to solve some of these problems that you can manage the numbers of physicians in a better way.
Jace, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Jace, yes. What's on your mind? Jace, I'm sorry. We've got a really bad phone signal. If you could try calling back in. Thank you. Well, we've talked an awful lot during this, and I think we've managed to convince everybody we got a problem here. We've got just a couple of minutes left, so let's assume for the moment that I'm going to give each of you dictatorial powers here to alter the system. What is one or two things we could do, you know, to alleviate this problem, to eliminate the shortage, as it were? I'll start with Dr. Allen.
I think the first thing we have to do is, if we look at this as a state problem, is to sit down as a state and get together and decide, okay, we have a problem, and to make some suggestions for how we can help with the state get more primary care doctors. Right now, it's pretty much, you know, the free enterprise. Everybody does what they want when they want, and we really don't have a master plan. So I think that would be a good start.
Dr. Bankston, again, you're given almost absolute power here to solve this problem. We've eliminated all constitutional safeguards so that you can, and we've just given you a charge. Go out here and find us more doctors.
Okay, two things. When I make all doctors operate like the Mayo Clinic does, where they're paid salaries and they're not paid on a per-patient or per-procedure basis, I think that would help in terms of the quality of care, and I also think it would decrease costs. And I also would increase the supply of nurse practitioners and physicians assistants who can provide a level of care appropriate to their education and take the burden off doctors so that we can use our doctor numbers more effectively.
Do you think there will ever be a point, I will get to you in a second, Dr. Evans, but Dr. Bankston, do you think there will ever be a point where physicians assistants, in effect, replace some of the services that we look to doctors to provide now?
Well, actually, it's already happening. Perhaps our other guests are more experts at this, but you know, the things are changing in terms of the laws and requirements in terms of their collaboration with other healthcare providers, physicians, and osteopaths. But the truth is that they can do many things that are appropriate to their education and provide fine care within the limits of their education, and we have to be careful about that, and that's one of the issues, how much can they do that's appropriate to their level of education. But it certainly is something you could do to reduce the burden on doctors.
Okay, and Dr. Evans, again, we've reversed the American Revolution here and made you an absolute monarch. How do we solve this problem?
I think the first thing on my list would be to look at the graduate medical education system in Indiana. If you go back and say, what are the influencing factors of where physicians actually choose to practice? The number one factor for getting a doctor to practice in an area is where they did their residency. So if we need primary care doctors, or we need obstetricians, or we need general surgeons, the first thing that we need to do is to look at our residency training programs and allow more opportunities for quality training for these graduate physicians, who will get a good training experience in an Indiana hospital and then will practice in this state. I think that probably will be the best bang for the buck in terms of getting these much-needed doctors into Indiana.
We've got just a few seconds left, but we've gotten a tweet in here at the 11th hour, as it were, that asks the question whether the life science boom here in Indiana is going to alleviate the problem or add to it. Dr. Allen, I'll start with you.
I think that it's a parallel process, but I don't think it's going to interfere or create problems with the physician.
Likely not to have much impact.
No, I don't think so. It seems to be attracting a different type of student.
Dr. Evans, do you agree?
In some instances, that's true. And in other instances, the fact that we are a life science center now and are growing and developing, we're actually attracting certain undergraduate students that maybe have an increase in looking at a medical career or even
So it could give us a competitive edge here in terms of recruiting medical students in the long term.
I think so.
This has been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank all of you for joining us. Dr. Bankston, thank you for spending this time with us.
You're very welcome.
Certainly. And Dr. Evans, thank you very much for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Allen, I enjoyed talking with you very much.
And I've enjoyed this too.
Thank you. We will be back next week when we will be talking about issues that interest Indiana and Hoosiers. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.